invite my great friend Michael Peruca to join me on the platform. Michael is a man I have learned a great deal from, and especially respect him for the great challenge that he took on in 2004, running for the highest office in the land, President of the United States. And in truth, I can say, he was the only man that you could rightly vote for in the 2004 election who would seek to do God's will in that position. And I can say that not only from knowledge before the election, but certainly knowledge after the election that has shown the difference it makes in who holds that office. Michael, would you come at this time and introduce our special guest? Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning. We just sang that third verse of America the Beautiful, which was a wonderful rendition, and it was great. It's great, especially after the tone is set by Sherlyn, to then open your throat and just sing that song. What a great feeling it is to sing that song. The words are so wonderful. In the third stanza, there is a phrase, "who more than self their country loved." And I think that describes our special guest and the man who will deliver our sermon today, "who more than self his country loved." I think that describes Chief Justice Roy Moore. It is a privilege to introduce him. I call him, he would not call himself this, but I call him an American hero. And since I have the microphone at the moment and he doesn't, I will proceed to defend that statement. He's an American hero because he is American and he is a hero. He is American because in the same way that Pastor described when he was talking to the children this morning, there is an American understanding of law and liberty and government. It's laid forth in our declaration that Pastor handed the children today. There is a God. Our rights come from him. The purpose of civil government is to protect those rights. That's it. That's it. That simple, biblical, straightforward understanding of law, the true source and nature of law, is exactly what our founders called upon and used as the raison d'etre, if you will, to declare their independence and their right to be 13 individual, divisible states. So there is an American view. So Chief Justice Roy Moore is an American, first of all, because he understands that view. He's a hero because he's willing to sacrifice for it. And he's demonstrated that to us. Psalm 11, verse 3 says, "If the foundations be destroyed, what can the righteous do?" And in that psalm, David is being advised by his advisors that, hey, look, the foundations are gone. We are righteous, but there's nothing for us to do. We got to flee to the mountains. We have to flee as a bird to the mountains. We have to get out of town because we don't have any place to stand. But David says, no. If the foundations are destroyed, what will we do? What will the righteous people do? The righteous people will rebuild the foundations. There's no place to run. And beside, the victory, David says, is already won. The victory is the Lord's. The battle belongs to the Lord. Chief Justice Roy Moore, when he stood up against the federal tyranny and the federal courts, sounded a clarion call for us. And many, many, myself included, responded. If I could just tell a very personal story, I had been asked to run for office during that time when the chief was engaged in this battle. I had been asked to run by the Constitution Party and to take the mantle and run that race. And I was very conflicted about that. I was very nervous and very anxious, and I was really, frankly, looking for ways to pass that buck. And I remember one night getting into bed and thinking about the events of the day and having seen Roy Moore on television, and I realized that if that man can stand on the bridge, can stand in the gap, can stand on the wall, then what kind of sissy am I if I don't jump in line and do the same thing? He has inspired many, many, many people to join in that most righteous effort and duty to rebuild the biblical foundations of American law and government. And so I introduce to you an American hero, Roy Moore. The Honorable Roy S. Moore.
Bless you. Please, thank you. Well, I don't know what to do when you're completely humbled. And, you know, as I came up here, I feel like maybe like the boys that went out to California and they got lost. They were from Alabama. You know, we talk a little differently down in Alabama. And so they were hunting for a city. They were trying to go to San Jose, California. They got lost, and so they stopped by a service station. They said to the proprietor, "Sir, we're trying to get out to San Jose." And the service station manager said, Where are you going? He said, "Well, we're going to San Jose." He said, "You mean San Jose?" He says, "In California, you've got to speak properly, and we pronounce our J's out here and softly, like Juan and Julio and Juarez." He said, "Well, how long are you boys going to be out in California?" He said, "Well, maybe to June or July." "Well, this is June and soon to be July, I guess, or this is July 1st. "What is the date? July 1st? Yeah. So I feel a little out of place here, like a fish out of water. I can't sing, and that's beautiful singing. I can't preach as your preacher. I'll assure you that. I don't have that eloquence. I can't play the guitar or the trumpet or anything else. I feel like, what am I doing up here, and why am I called a hero? Well, I don't feel like a hero. Actually, when I started this battle with the Ten Commandments, I had not an inkling of knowledge of the First Amendment, the United States Constitution. Now I see Herb Titus back there. Now I'm completely humble. One of the great scholars of our time about the Constitution. And when I started and when I put the Ten Commandments on the wall in my courthouse, I couldn't find the First Amendment. I certainly didn't know what it said, what it meant, and I had been in law for 20-something years. But you see, there's a principle of Scripture about that. God doesn't want our wisdom. He doesn't want our knowledge. He doesn't need it. He has everything. He wants our faith. As it is written, the just shall live by faith. And that's what it's all about. So I didn't do anything special to be up here except say no. Now, that's not a hard word. And no means no. And we stood against the federal tyranny that threatened to take the right to acknowledge God from us. And as I was listening to the music and the singing and the beautiful prayers, I was thinking of Psalm 100, because it's kind of summed up what the pastor was saying to the children. Make a joyful noise unto the Lord, all ye lands. Serve the Lord with gladness. Come before his presence with singing. Know ye that the Lord, he is God. It is he that has made us, not we ourselves. We are his sheep, we are his people, and the sheep of his pasture. Enter into his gates with thanksgiving, and enter his courts with praise. Be thankful unto him, and bless his name, for the Lord is good, for his mercy is everlasting. His truth endureth to all generations. And that's what we've got to do, is bless the name of the Lord. But today in our country, we've got a problem, especially in our court system. Now, I, being a judge, have looked at judges for the past several years. And I'll tell you a story about one judge. He was an older judge on the federal bench. been there many years. And the courtroom came to order as the next witness was called into his court. Now the bailiff was a young boy, just about 6 years old. And the judge's heart was moved to compassion at seeing such a young child to be put on the stand in a serious case. No, we don't like to have children on the stand. That's not easy. And the jury certainly had a lot of sympathy for this young witness. So the judge turned to the little boy and he said, "Son, what's your name?" The little boy said, "My name's Johnny." "Judge?" He said, "Well, Johnny, do you go to school?" He says, "Yes, sir." So he says, "Johnny, do you know what it means to tell the truth?" Johnny said, "Yes, sir, I do." He said, "Well, Johnny, tell us, why should little boys tell the truth?" Johnny looked up at the judge, his big brown eyes, and said, "Because God says so, Judge." This judge was a little taken back. You know, it's a little embarrassing in courts these days to talk about God. You don't like to talk about things like that. And the judge didn't know how to respond. He was embarrassed. If you don't think judges get a little taken back at talking about God, ask Jennifer Kaufman. She was district judge in Kentucky in 2001 that said that portions of the Declaration of Independence, like, "We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal," is religious. It couldn't be displayed in our schools. Or you could ask Alfred Goodwin. And Alfred Goodwin's a fine judge out in California that said, "We can't have under God in the pledge. That's religious." Or you could go to Alabama in 2002. That was the judge in my case, Myron Thompson, who said, "While the Chief Justice is free to keep whatever religious belief he chooses, the state may not acknowledge the sovereignty of the Judeo-Christian God and attribute to that God our religious freedom." On November 12th of 2003, I was in a courtroom, and I was asked some questions by an attorney general who's later been appointed to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. Now, there weren't any recordings there. My attorneys were there. And one of my attorneys here, Ben Dupre, is going to be speaking, and I know Herb Titus is going to be speaking. And Michael Perutka is going to be speaking at this conference. And if you get a chance, I want you to come, not to hear me, certainly, but to hear some great American minds in the legal field tell you about what our country's about. But I was sitting in this courtroom where I had once presided as the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Alabama. And I'll tell you about being humbled when you're on trial in the courtroom where you once presided over. That's humbling. And they had a lot of little rules and things that they insisted upon. One thing is they turned my back to the court. I couldn't even see the court. They had the chair seated to where I was facing the audience. So the first thing I did, I went up and I moved the chair. Nobody said a word. They also had a rule that they couldn't have cameras in the courtroom. They had forbidden the television cameras from coming in, even though I had requested it. There was no jury in the case. I was on trial. But they still wouldn't let cameras in the courtroom. In fact, the judge issued an order that it couldn't be not only cameras, but you couldn't have a recording device. There were no recording devices. But you know, God has control of things, and through the librarian, who wasn't necessarily my friend, he decided to use the court cameras to record the proceedings so he could sell them and make money for the court. And he asked the judge permission to do that. The judge said, well, we'll let you do that. So they made these videos, and then they released them for sale and made people who bought them sign a statement that they wouldn't use them for anything. Well, they had to give my attorneys one. And I didn't sign anything. And I've not been very bashful at showing what went on in that courtroom, because you've got to understand, I didn't know what was going on, what I was going to be asked. And the prosecutor, who is the attorney general, certainly didn't know he was being filmed. So he asked the basic question, which is at the root of all the problems in our country. I don't care what legal case you talk about with regard to the First Amendment. Are we going to acknowledge the sovereignty of God? Are we going to sit in churches and sing about God and talk about God and go out there and say, but we can't acknowledge God? I'm going to talk to you about that, but I want you to see a little clip of that video. If y'all could dim the lights, it might help. And we'll show you exactly what went on. It just takes a few seconds. So watch carefully and watch the expression on the prosecutor's face as I was giving him my answer.
And your understanding is that the federal court ordered that you could not acknowledge God, isn't that right?
Yes.
And if you resume your duties as Chief Justice after this proceeding, you will continue acknowledge God as you have testified that you would today.
Absolutely.
No matter what any other official says.
Absolutely. Without an acknowledgement of God, I cannot do my duty. I must acknowledge God. It says so in the Constitution of Alabama. It says so in every Constitution. It says so in everything I've read. So,
the only point I'm trying to clarify, Mr. Chief Justice, is not why, but only that, in fact, if you do resume your duties as Chief Justice, you will continue to do that in regard to what any other official says. Isn't that right?
Well, I will do the same thing this court did in starting with prayer. That's an acknowledgement of God. I would do the same thing that justices do when they place their hand on the Bible and say, so help me God. It's an acknowledgement of God. The Alabama Supreme Court opens with, God save the state and this honorable court. It's an acknowledgement of God, in my opinions, which I've written many opinions, acknowledging God as the source, a moral source of our law. I think you must.
I think you must. That was completely unprepared. But you can understand how the judges in our country are a little taken back, a little bit confused when you start talking about God in a courtroom. And so this judge who was looking at little Johnny didn't really know how to respond to Johnny. So he said, no, Johnny, I mean, what happens to little boys who don't tell the truth? Johnny just looked back up at the judge and said, they go to hell, Judge. Now, if you think the judge didn't want to talk about God, let me tell you. He really didn't want to talk about hell. I mean, this is way off, and he was getting kind of angry, and so he turned to Johnny and said, no, Johnny, I mean, what else happens to little boys that don't tell the truth? Johnny said, gosh, Judge, isn't that enough? Well, it was enough to acknowledge God on November 20th of 1620, when our founding fathers and the Pilgrims stepped off the ship Mayflower. Before they got off, they formed a compact known as the Mayflower Compact. They said, having undertaken for the glory of God and the advancement of the Christian faith, we have undertaken this voyage for the King and for God. They weren't embarrassed like that judge and like so many today. Like the Apostle Paul, as it stated in Romans 1st chapter, the 16th and 17th verse, they were not ashamed of the gospel of Christ. For it is the power of God to salvation, to everyone that believeth, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For therein is the righteousness of God revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith. It always began by faith. Just like when I put that monument on the wall or the plaque initially in 1992. It was just by faith. Not by wisdom, not by might, by the Spirit of God. Are we ashamed today of being Christian? Do we go out in public and you're a Christian? It was enough over 150 years later when 56 men gathered in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and wrote those words, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." You know, that's astounding. That is the principle upon which this nation began. That God gave us life. God gave us liberty. And God allowed us to pursue our happiness, because justice and felicity or happiness was so interconnected, so inseparably interwoven, that the laws of eternal justice could not deny happiness. That's written in Romans 1, 19 and 20. "Because that which may be known of God is manifest or evident in them, for God hath showed it unto them. For the invisible things of Him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse." You see, they didn't need an excuse. They knew God was sovereign. What is our excuse today in this country? We don't have one. It should be evident in us. It is manifest that God created us. They knew that God was sovereign. It was enough when the first president of the United States gave his first inaugural address on April 30th, 1789. He said, "It would be peculiarly improper to omit in this first official act my fervent supplications to that almighty being who presides over the councils of nations. His providential aids can supply every human defect." His first act was prayer, supplication to God. He went on to say that no people can be bound to acknowledge and adore the invisible hand which conducts the affairs of men more than the people of the United States. Every step by which they have advanced the character of an independent nation seems to have been distinguished by some token of providential agency. You will join with me, I trust, in thinking there are none under the influence of which the proceedings of a new and free government can more auspiciously commence. One nation under God. He wasn't ashamed. He wasn't embarrassed. He didn't get sued by the ACLU. In fact, they weren't there. After the president's speech, they went back to Federal Hall after going to church. They went back to Federal Hall, and from June to September, they started debating the words of the First Amendment. What were we going to say about the First Amendment? Of course, as I recall, it was the Third Amendment then, but later became the First. And they finally reached the words that they felt were appropriate. "Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion." If y'all can dim those lights, it might. "Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion, prohibiting the free exercise thereof, abridging the freedom of speech of the press, the right of the people peaceably assembled, and petitioning the government for redress of grievances." The last part, of course, not relevant to our discussion here. The first part being, Congress can't make a law about religion. It's called, for those intellectuals that write on the court, the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause. Not very complicated. It says establish religion or the free exercise of religion. They make it sound sometimes very complicated. But after they wrote that, on that very day of September 25th, 1789, the day they decided that that's what they wanted to do, guess what they did during the same thing? They set a day of thanksgiving and prayer to Almighty God. Mr. Boudinot said he could not think of letting the session pass over without offering an opportunity to let all the citizens of the United States join with one voice in returning to Almighty God their sincere thanks for the many blessings He had poured down upon them. Resolved that a joint committee of both houses be directed to wait upon the President and request that he recommend to the people a day of public thanksgiving and prayer to be observed by acknowledging with grateful hearts the many unsigned favors of Almighty God, especially by affording them an opportunity peaceably to establish a constitution of government for their safety and happiness. And then 8 days later, on October 3rd, the first president in his first presidential proclamation says, whereas it is the duty of all nations to acknowledge the providence of Almighty God, to obey His will, to be grateful for His benefits, and humbly to implore His protection and favor. And insomuch that both houses of Congress have asked me to do this. We want to establish a day to acknowledge with grateful hearts the many and signal favors of Almighty God. These people were not embarrassed. They were not ashamed. Well, historically, anyway, they weren't. I could recite history all up to the present time. But what about legally? What about legally? Can we do it? Certainly, historically, we could do it. And certainly, they felt no legal prohibitions from acknowledging God. What is the role of a judge? I don't know if we have any judges in here, but if we did, I could tell you. When you get on a court before a jury, and you try a case with assault with a deadly weapon, you have to define for that jury what the legislature meant by a deadly weapon. If somebody throws a wadded up napkin or something at somebody, it's not assaulting them with a deadly weapon, unless a judge decides to interpret a napkin as a deadly weapon. Well, they don't do that. When they try a rape case or a murder case or a robbery case, they define the elements of the crime. They're required to by the law. In every court, even if you go to a municipal court and you talk about fishing without a license. Now, I've given this example many times, but when you come before a judge for fishing without a license because you were walking down by a stream and you picked up a stick, if you were on trial for fishing without a license, you'd probably say, "Judge, I just picked up a stick off the ground." What would you do if the judge said, "Well, sir or madam, I don't know what fishing means. But even though you didn't have a line on that stick and didn't have weight or bait or hook, I presume y'all fish in Maryland like we do in Alabama. What if the judge said, "But you could kill a fish with a stick"? You would probably cry out in anger, "I don't want to go to jail for picking up a stick off the ground." Well, judges are not supposed to be ruling by their feelings. They're supposed to be ruling by the law. So let's look at the law again. Congress shall make no law respecting the established religion or prohibiting the fair exercise thereof. That is the law that they say prevents us from acknowledging God, the sovereignty of God. So we've got to define those words. Religion and thereof, which is religion. We've got to define religion. Well, who would know better what the definition was that the man that offered the amendment to Congress, the man who wrote the Memorial Remonstrance, the chief architect of the Constitution, James Madison, and he said, "We hold it for a fundamental and undeniable truth that religion or the duty which we owe to the Creator and the manner of discharging it can be directed only by reason and conviction, not by force and violence." Religion is the duties we owe to God and how you discharge those duties. Actually, it's the first table of the law, the duties you owe to God, the first four commandments, and how you perform those duties, whether you're a member of a Methodist, Catholic, Baptist, or what form of faith you are, that's your religion. So if you take religion as the duty we owe to the Creator and the manner of discharging it, and you put it in the First Amendment, look what you've got. Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of what? The duties you owe to the Creator in the manner of discharging, or prohibiting what? The duties you owe to the Creator in the manner of discharging it. Bingo. The law acknowledges God. You can't get not only historically, but the law itself acknowledges God. But let's go back to what Judge Thompson said in his opinion about the words religion. He said, the plaintiffs have not presented an alternate definition of religion. And look what he said. The court lacks the expertise to formulate its own definition of religion for First Amendment purposes. In other words, he's saying, I don't know how to define religion, just like that judge didn't know how to define fishing. He even went on to say that, therefore, because the court cannot formulate its own, it must refuse the Chief Justice's invitation to define religion. Since I can't define it, he says, since the court couldn't define it, he was going to refuse my invitation to define it. I wasn't inviting him to define it. I was asking him to please do his job. He put, indeed, the Chief Justice's definition of religion proves, if anything, now, what was my definition? What the Supreme Court had once said it was. I didn't make up one. I quoted the United States Supreme Court in 1878. I quoted the Memorial Remonstrance, which was attached to Jefferson versus Board of Education in 1947. I didn't make up a definition, but he said my definition was unwise and even dangerous to put forth as a matter of law. There are consequences to doing these things. Now, if you were talking about the fishing example, what would the consequence be? Sitting in jail, in a cold, hard jail behind bars. That's a consequence. What's the consequence of what they're doing in the First Amendment? They're depriving us of our right to acknowledge God. The United States Supreme Court in 1931 had a case where a Canadian pastor came down and didn't want to take an oath to fight in foreign wars. It was called U.S. versus McIntosh. Justice Sutherland, who was not the Chief Justice, he was one of the justices, he had to talk about where this man got this right to do what he wanted to do or to refuse to take the oath. Where did his right to religion come from? He said, we are a Christian people. According to one another, the equal right of religious freedom and acknowledging with reverence the duty of obedience to the will of God. Now, Justice Sutherland was a United States Supreme Court justice. He was not ashamed, he was not embarrassed to say, we are a Christian people. I'll bet you can't find one on the court today that would say that. In fact, I know you can't find one on the court today that say, we are a Christian people. In fact, I don't even know if you could find one on the court today that recognizes, and maybe there are, I'm not saying there aren't, that religious liberty comes from God. Now, I want you to understand that was a majority opinion, too. That was what the majority of the court signed on to. But there was a minority opinion, a dissent. Now, what was the dissent? Well, that was the judges that didn't, actually in the case, they found the man didn't have to take the oath. I believe that's right. Or had to take the oath. I'm sorry, I got it backwards. He had to take the oath. Well, Chief Justice Charles Evans Hughes said he didn't think he had to. So what was he using for a basis of his opinion? He said the essence of religion is a belief in a relationship to God involving duties superior to those arising from any human relation. One cannot speak of religious liberty with proper appreciation of its essential and historic significance without assuming the existence of a belief in supreme allegiance to the will of God. Now there's a court for you when the majority and minority both base their decision on the will of God. That was 1931. 1946, 15 years later, had another Canadian pastor come down, didn't want to take the oath. This time they found out, or they found that they overturned the holding of that case, and they said, this time you don't have to take the oath. But look at their reasoning in 1946. The struggle for religious liberty has through the centuries been an effort to accommodate the demands of the state or the conscience of the individual to the demands of the state. The victory for freedom of thought recorded in our Bill of Rights recognizes that in the domain of conscience, what we believe, what we think, there is a moral power higher than the state. And throughout the ages, men have suffered death rather than subordinate their allegiance to God to the authority of the state. And freedom of religion guaranteed by the First Amendment is a product of that struggle. You see, they recognized a moral power higher. They recognized that the right to believe what we want comes from God. But in 2002, Myron Thompson said this: the court cannot accept the Chief Justice's proposed definition of religion because it is, simply put, incorrect and religiously offensive. Now, who stood for the law? The book that will be, I brought, I think Mr. Pruke has some, So Help Me God, will tell what went on in our battle in Montgomery, which Dr. Titus, Herb Titus, and Ben Dupre, and Michael Peruca, and others were involved in. And what really happened, I run the Foundation for Moral Law in Montgomery, Alabama, and we try to teach. That's what we're up here to do, is talk to pastors and preachers about these things. But basically, we've got to understand that there is a battle going on in our country today. We are in Iraq fighting a war. We're in Afghanistan. We've fought wars, I guess, all over the globe. And I hear these people talk about freedom and liberty, and it's good that we're patriotic. But we've got to understand there's a battle here, right here in this state, and in every state, over our right to acknowledge the sovereignty of the Judeo-Christian God. And it's not hard. You're on one side or the other, and I don't care if you're male or female, young or old, black or white, it doesn't matter. You're on one side or the other. Intellectual or non-intellectual, from Alabama or from California, or from Maryland, you're in the battle. If you think you're not, you are. I'll just tell you that. Today we face another war fought not upon some distant shore, nor against a foe that you can see, but one as ruthless as can be. He'll take your life. He'll take your children too, and say there's nothing you can do. He'll make you think that wrong is right. It's just a sign to stand and fight. Though we face the wrath of hell, against those gates we shall prevail. in homes and schools across our land, it's time for Christians to take a stand. When our work on this earth is done, when the battle is over and the victory is won, and through all the earth His praise will ring and all the heavenly angels will sing, it'll be enough just to see the Son and hear Him say, "My child, well done. You've kept my faith so strong and true. I knew that I could count on you." Can He count on you? I think there's a new day in America. I guess you can think what you want. But I can see a change. I can feel a change coming about. The preachers are starting to understand that they haven't been doing what they're supposed to do. State and local and county and federal officials are starting to take a stand and do things. Oh, there's a lot on the other side too. Don't get me wrong. They haven't stopped. In fact, they've increased. But if you look closely, what they're doing is a result of what's occurring in America. Their time is short because people are waking up. "Then they that feared the Lord spake often with another, one with another. And the Lord hearkened and heard it, and a book of remembrance was written before Him for them that feared the Lord, that thought upon His name. And they shall be mine, saith the Lord of hosts, in the day when I make up my jewels, and I will spare them as a man spareth his own son that serveth him. Then shall you return and discern between the righteous and the wicked, between him that serveth God and him that serveth Him not. For behold, the day cometh that shall burn as an oven, and all the proud, yea, and all that do wickedly shall be stubble. And the day that cometh shall burn them up, saith the Lord of hosts, that it shall leave them neither root nor branch. But unto you that fear my name shall the Son of Righteousness arise with healing in His wings, and you shall go forth and grow up as calves of the stall. You shall tread down the wicked, and they shall be ashes under the sole of your feet in the day that I do this, saith the Lord of hosts. Remember ye the law of Moses, my servant, which I commanded him at Horeb for all Israel with the statutes and judgments. Behold, I will send you Elijah, the prophet, before the coming of that great and dreadful day of the Lord. And he shall turn the hearts of the fathers to the children and the hearts of the children to the fathers, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse." So there's your duty. If you've got children, grandchildren, teach them. Everybody's got a duty. Not just Michael for running for president, which would be a blessing if he had been elected. Not just like Herb Titus, who represents so many on behalf of God and this country. We've all got duties. Your duty is to teach your children and to stand up in your workplace, in your schools, because there is a war. Everybody can't be a lawyer. We thank God for that. And everybody can't be a preacher. But everybody's in the battle. And I thank you for the opportunity to come and speak to you and encourage you to go hear these men that have greater wisdom than I. They know what's going on, and they'll be able to give you I know Ben's doing something on what preachers used to do in this country. Very interesting. And whatever Herb Titus says is interesting. God bless you, and thank you.